Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Doug Ireland of In These Times magazine, who assesses the results of the French presidential election and the rise of right-wing parties across the European continent. Noam Wiener, a lieutenant in the Israeli Defense Force, who explains why he and more than 450 other reservists have refused to serve in the occupied territories. And Patrick Woodall, research director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses the ongoing campaign to defeat fast-track trade legislation now before the U.S. Senate. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Although the Taliban regime in Afghanistan has fallen, the intensity of the U.S. military buildup continues. The Bush administration has plans to boost its presence in the former Soviet Asian republics, such as Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan. The region is strategically located to advance American military and economic interests and to expand ties with Central Asia's booming energy industry. Further, more U.S. bases in Central Asia will put Russia and China on the defensive. For 100 years, Central Asia has been Russia's own backyard, and China is very uneasy about having American troops on its western border. The Bush administration is looking to benefit from oil production in Turkmenistan and Kyrgyzstan. Last fall, Kyrgyzstan officials opened a pipeline that is routed through Russia. Now the U.S. is eager to have a second pipeline built through Turkey, a NATO ally, an idea Russian President Vladimir Putin is not enthusiastic about. Still, the Central Asian countries are human rights disasters. Human Rights Watch has charged the security service in Uzbekistan with torture and the murder of 16 prisoners since 1999. Yet, the U.S. State Department has agreed to triple its aid to the Uzbek government with no aid tied to improvements in human rights. In the months following the United States invasion of Afghanistan, U.S. newspapers and magazines began to publish pictures of newly liberated Afghan women, free of the burqa that once covered their faces. The implication of these pictures being that, somehow, the U.S. war on Afghanistan was benefiting Afghan women and children. A report released last week by the U.S. relief organization Save the Children directly challenges those assumptions. The report, titled State of the World's Mothers, points to the fact that 90% of the victims of modern wars are women and children. The report goes on to explain that these deaths cannot be considered accidental, that they are deliberate and systemic. The hardships imposed by war often make it difficult or impossible for women and children to obtain food, to fight injury or disease, and many are forced into military servitude or sexual exploitation. In the last 10 years, 2 million children worldwide have been killed in armed conflicts, and another 12 million have been orphaned. Of 156 countries studied, Afghanistan ranks the lowest in the well-being of children, the indicators being access to safe water, nutritional status, primary school enrollment, and infant mortality. A woman in Afghanistan is 1,200 times more likely to die in childbirth than a woman from Switzerland. The study by Save the Children highlights an inextricable link between the survival of children and the well-being of their mothers, especially in times of war, when women are often the only persons left to hold their families and even entire communities together. Mother Jones magazine reports that President George W. Bush has put his own man on the Federal Election Commission, which will oversee the recently adopted campaign finance law that bans soft money contributions. Just days before Bush signed the Shays-Meehan bill into law, the administration appointed Michael Toner, chief counsel to the Republican National Committee, to fill a seat on the FEC. In his political post with the GOP, Toner had opposed campaign reform initiatives, including Alaska's ban on soft money. Currently, Democrats and Republicans each pick three FEC commissioners. As a result, the FEC is often divided, and the commission can take years to rule on campaign violations. In the near future, the FEC will decide how to enforce the new soft money ban that goes into effect after this November's election. The FEC will also have to rule on what constitutes coordination between federal political campaigns and outside groups. Larry Noble, head of the Center for Responsive Politics, remarked, "Keep in mind, the soft money loophole was created by the FEC through advisory opinions back in 1979. Will it find other loopholes to make it as weak as before?" Campaign reformers are looking to restructure the FEC and transform it into a law enforcement agency. One idea is to get rid of the six commissioners and hire a strong director. Joshua Rosenkrantz, founder of the New York University's Brennan Center for Justice, observed, "Three foxes and three hens are in charge of the chicken coop. There needs to be a single head that is accountable." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and your reporter, Sasha Summer Cousineau.
Jean-Marie Le Pen, leader of the neo-fascist National Front Party, shocked many in France and Europe in April when he captured enough votes to enter the final round of the French presidential election May 5th. Surpassing the Socialist Party of Prime Minister Lionel Jospin, Le Pen faced off against the conservative incumbent Jacques Chirac. During the first round vote, many French voters stayed home, owing to the perceived lack of difference between Chirac and Jospin. But Le Pen's entry into the final round with 17% of the vote woke up the French electorate, prompting 1.5 million to take to the streets in anti-Le Pen protests. With the backing of rival socialists, Chirac overwhelmed Le Pen in the May 5th vote by an 82-18% margin. Although Le Pen was soundly defeated, he did manage to increase his support in the second round by almost 1 million votes, a fact which confirmed Le Pen's appeal to voters angry at immigrants, rising crime rates, and elite politicians. Le Pen and his party hoped to capitalize on hostility toward the European Union and anti-globalization sentiment in legislative elections set for June 9th and 16th. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Doug Ireland, a contributing editor at In These Times magazine, who lived in France and reported on French politics for over a decade. He assesses the results of the French presidential election and the rise of right-wing parties across the European continent, already in power in Italy, Portugal, and Norway.
Even though Chirac was re-elected with almost 82% of the vote, the results showed absolutely no diminution of the score for Le Pen, who was a racist, and a fascist. Even more disturbing, if you look at the runoff results, was that after 2 weeks between the first round of voting and the runoff, during which there was an unprecedented pummeling and targeting of Le Pen by all of the mass media, print and electronic, who abandoned their neutrality, by all the unions, all of the traditional parties of the left and the right. Chirac owes the massive character of his re-election to the left electorate. Attacking Le Pen as a fascist were all most of the major French sports stars and entertainment figures, leading business organizations, and even the Catholic Episcopate, which never takes a position in elections, called for a vote against Le Pen. Despite all of that, Le Pen actually increased his vote. What the runoff vote on this past Sunday confirmed was the strong implantation of the National Front, the neo-fascist party, in a number of significant regions in France.
Doug Ireland, what in your mind is Le Pen's appeal to French voters? Is it the crime issue or the backlash against immigrants? Is it the lack of credibility of the major political parties? Is it a neo-fascist streak within the French populace at large?
It's all three. In the first place, the issue of crime is the issue of immigrants. Crime has been exaggerated by the media and by politicians. It has been Le Pen's stock in trade to blame everything on the immigrants. Crime, unemployment, high taxes. Both the conservative Chirac and the socialist Jospin legitimized Le Pen's raising of the crime issue as the central issue in French life by adopting their own attitudes toward it, which were draconian. And therefore, they legitimized Le Pen's view of crime.
One of the other issues that Le Pen and his party members harped on was the specter of globalization. And we've seen quite a bit of activism across the world from progressive movements against corporate-led globalization. But it seems that Le Pen also capitalized on fear in opposition to the direction of global economics. Can you address what it says about the mainstream French parties in their inability to address the issue of globalization?
What we've seen in the last few years is that this increasing alienation from the traditional political parties on the part of working class voters who sense that they have no more say in control over their own lives is intensified by the process of globalization. In France, there have been an extraordinary number of plant closings in the last few years by multinational corporations, from Danone to Daewoo. And the socialist government of Lionel Jospin and his plural left coalition seemed absolutely impotent in the face of these plant closings. Indeed, Jospin, who lost the presidency 7 years before to Chirac when Chirac was elected by only 6 points, had governed for the last 5 years in a way that, on the strategy that by governing to the center-right on economic issues, he could make up those 6 points that he'd lost the presidency by 7 years previously. Well, the lesson of the recent history in Italian politics, France's neighbor, is that when a government that is elected as a government of the left applies economic policies of the right, the resultant disillusionment creates an opening for the extreme right and the neo-fascist right. And that's exactly what happened in France. So clearly, when you have left governments that disillusion their base by applying the right-wing economic policies, which is exactly what happened in Italy when the Party of Democratic Socialism, led by Massimo Delemo, applied an austerity program, the result was that Silvio Berlusconi and his neo-fascist coalition partners swept the next elections.
What are some of your concerns about the rise of the right throughout Europe, not just France, but across the continent? And how best do you think progressive forces in the continent should confront the rise of the xenophobic neo-fascist right?
The European social democratic left, as it has moved to the right over these last 20 years, hasn't really figured out how to tackle the problem of racism. It's been afraid to. And until it begins to face up to the problems of having real urban policies, real projects and programs for integrating the immigrant populations, which even in their third and fourth generation are subjected to terrible discrimination and educational disadvantages. Until the left begins to deal with those problems in a forthright way, you're going to continue to have this growth of the extreme right.
That was Doug Ireland, contributing editor at In These Times magazine. Read Ireland's analysis of the French elections online at www.inthesetimes.com. In the face of defiance from Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan abandoned the Security Council-endorsed investigation into the conduct of Israeli soldiers who attacked the Palestinian Jenin refugee camp. Sharon, who flew to Washington on May 6th for talks with President Bush, advocated the exclusion of Yasser Arafat from future peace talks and took time to thank the White House for their help in blocking the human rights inquiry. Although Mr. Sharon has gained broad public support for his invasion of Palestinian West Bank cities, not all Israelis are applauding their government's policies. Hundreds of Israeli reserve soldiers who oppose their nation's 35-year occupation of the West Bank and Gaza have signed a public declaration refusing to serve in the occupied territories. Since January 25th, more than 450 Israeli soldiers have signed onto the Courage to Refuse campaign, which proclaims that we shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. Thus far, 41 resistors have been sent to military prison for their disobedience. Noam Wiener is a 27-year-old lieutenant in the Israeli Army Reserves and a law student who has signed the Courage to Refuse declaration. He traveled to the U.S. in May and addressed audiences at Yale University, community groups, and a local synagogue in New Haven, Connecticut. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Noam Wiener about why he has refused to serve in the occupied territories and in so doing risks imprisonment.
I've always known that the occupation, it's inherent to the occupation that you're going to injure other people's human rights and that you're going to have parts of the population that are pretty much non-legal entities. Why I've decided to refuse now is that I've come to the realization that the current Israeli administration is not looking to end the occupation. And while I could rationalize to myself my service in the West Bank as an occupier, saying that I'm only doing something temporary until a peace comes around, I could no longer rationalize that to myself. And it's very difficult to decide to refuse. But once that rationalization was gone, the only thing that was left was oppression. I decided that I will no longer take part of it.
What are some of the main effects that you have seen of the occupation on the Palestinian population as you've witnessed it as a soldier?
I think that when a population is under occupation for such a long time, well, first of all, it creates a lot of anger. And a lot of anger is not always being aimed just at Israel. I think the whole population, the whole Palestinian population, is again under such stress that it creates a lot of negative effects over there too. I think it creates a lot of poverty and it creates radicalism in general. And in the West Bank, this creates a lot of very zealous religious movements. And when people disparage of humans and humanity, they do some pretty awful things. I think that's one of the reasons you get the reactions that you get now from Palestinian streets and from Arabs all over.
What kind of abuses have you seen the Israeli army commit in the occupation that contributes to your decision not to serve?
Well, I've not seen things that you could point out to immediately and say, oh, that's a horrific thing, or not to a very large extent. I think the very occupation, the very limiting of people's right to make decisions regarding their own lives is probably the worst thing. Yes, there's house demolitions and there's roadblocks, but I think the arbitrariness of the governance is the root of the whole thing. I think that's what causes the most anger among Palestinians.
What would you say the occupation's effect on Israeli society has been from your experience serving in the West Bank as a soldier and also as a civilian?
I think the main problem with the occupation is referring to, well, first of all, it creates a lot of stress in the Israeli society because of the Palestinian resistance. And it's very stressful on people themselves because when you're out there in the territories you're a soldier, but you're doing policing work. You do things that even if they aren't criminal in themselves, they're oppressive to a whole population. And that does create stress within people. And everybody's who's not completely autistic, even if it's deep from within inside, that revolts against this. So I think, it does have negative effects on Israeli society. It definitely doesn't make the population better. Well, it does a lot to lessen people's sensitivity, and I think it denotes their ability to empathize with other people around them because you do grow a thicker skin.
What has the reaction been in Israel to the movement? You have about 500 people who signed the letter of resistance thus far. How would you characterize the response in Israel to it?
Well, I would say that to a certain amount of the people were heroes, and to another certain amount of the people were complete traitors and nihilistic radicals that should be thrown out of the country. I think the institutional response to us has mainly been that we're a danger to democracy. Our aim is mainly to create doubt in people's minds as referring to the correctness or the propriety of what the Israeli government is doing. And I think we've done that to a large degree. People who are very far to the right, who don't agree to the very premises of what we think of, their reaction is less important to me or to us. The reaction of the left is what we're looking for. We're looking to wake people up to what's happening, and I think on that note, we've been quite successful.
What's your message to Jews living here in the United States? What would you like to see U.S. Jews discuss in regards to the occupation that maybe you're not seeing now?
I think that the Israeli right, and it's now in government, and also I suppose the right-wing American Jewry, has very successfully made a complete semblance between support of Israel and support of Sharon's plan. And I think it's very important for American Jewry to realize that they can support Israel and say that the occupation is wrong. I am quite patriotic. I definitely believe that Israel has a right to exist. I think the occupation is horrible. And I think that American Jewry should understand that it's very difficult to break this dichotomy. And I think American Jews are the ones who can do it most effectively.
That was Noam Wiener, a lieutenant in the Israeli army who assigned the courage to refuse declaration. Contact the group's U.S. support network by calling area code 312-409-4845 or visit their website at www.couragetorefuse.org. Last December, the House of Representatives approved by a one-vote margin the Trade Promotion Authority Bill, opposed by many labor, environmental, and human rights activists. The legislation, more commonly known as Fast Track, is now being considered by the U.S. Senate and is designed to grant the president authority to negotiate future international trade deals with minimal debate in Congress and no chance for legislators to propose corrective amendments. If signed into law, Fast Track will enable the White House to expedite approval of the controversial Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty. FTAA, like the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been criticized for the lack of labor or environmental standards and the power it surrenders to corporations. Although passage in the Senate is likely, a broad coalition of groups opposed to Fast Track are promoting several amendments that they say will defend workers' rights and protect public health, safety, and environmental regulations. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Patrick Woodall, research director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch, who discusses what's at stake in the current campaign to defeat fast-track trade legislation.
I think it's good to start with last December when, after a year of extremely intense grassroots activism, the House managed to pass fast-track by only one vote on 215 to 214, and they had to do it with extreme party arm-twisting and a lot of pork barrel giveaways. And it's a sign of how powerful the grassroots opposition to these corporate-managed trade deals is that even during a time of war, a presidential priority like Fast Track could have such a narrow passage. This week, the Senate will take up a similar but not identical Fast Track package, and it's unclear what its prospects are. Its current underlying legislation is significantly different than the House legislation, which will require, even if it does pass the Senate, that it will have to go to a conference committee and require final passage in both bodies sometime later in the summer. So for the grassroots that have been working very hard to prevent this kind of unconstitutional fast-track delegation of authority from the Congress to the president, there's still plenty of time and a lot of work to be done.
Now, the most immediate treaty that this fast-track negotiating authority will be applied to, as I understand it, is the Free Trade Area of the Americas. And there was a large protest last spring up in Quebec City, and there's been a lot of activity all throughout, both North America and South America, Central America. Civil society has made known their opposition to many planks in the FTAA. Is that sort of what's at stake in the end about the fast-track negotiating authority this time around?
I mean, there are two kind of obvious things. One is the FTAA, which is essentially a 31-nation expansion of NAFTA, which would expand NAFTA essentially from Alaska all the way to Argentina. The other is the next round of the World Trade Organization talks. You remember in 99 in Seattle, when there was huge civil society opposition to the talks, they broke down when the developing world essentially said they weren't just going to accept any deal the rich nations offered. So they're still trying to revive those talks. So that would be the second element that would be dealt with. I think in the immediate future, you're right, the FTAA is of huge concern. Most of the problems with NAFTA are being negotiated to be expanded throughout the hemisphere. So problems that exist in the Maquiladora free trade area in Mexico, where there are really fairly abusive labor conditions, where U.S. companies are using Mexican labor quite harshly to ship commercial imports back into the U.S. would just be expanded all the way across Latin America. To the extent that NAFTA is extremely extractive, it encourages increased lumbering and it encourages the increased extraction of natural resources. That would only increase further, particularly in very delicate ecosystems in, for example, the Brazilian rainforest.
Talk about the coalition that's formed around opposition to Fast Track and what the strategy is at this point.
Well, I think one of the great things about working on this, on globalization issues, is the breadth of the coalition. It includes environmental groups, it includes religious groups, it includes women's groups, it includes labor groups, it includes consumer and citizens groups like Public Citizen. It includes an incredibly wide variety of folks that are working to make trade agreements work not just for big business, but work for everybody. Right now, most of these agreements are being negotiated essentially at the behest of corporations, and it's time that they be negotiated at the behest of the people. So right now, what's happened, as I said, in 2001, there was an incredibly broad grassroots organizing movement to make sure to hold members of Congress accountable to try and defeat Fast Track. And despite the popularity of a wartime president, we almost managed to do it, and in the end lost by only one vote. But with the understanding that the vote was kept open for 40 minutes, even though most votes expire after 15 minutes, and it required political horse trading. Now the legislation is in the Senate, and there, although the Senate, being a much more conservative body, is much more generally pro-trade, and it's very likely that it will pass. However, there are a number of very good amendments which will change the bill significantly and require a second vote in both houses, which will give the grassroots an opportunity to exert more pressure and to make a lot of folks who voted for Fast Track in the House that really probably shouldn't have change their votes and defeat it.
That was Patrick Woodall, Research Director with Public Citizens Global Trade Watch. Contact the group by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.tradewatch.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.